from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
A failure, sexist, pathetic. Those are just a few of the harsh words used to describe how Matt Lauer moderated NBC's first commander-in-chief forum with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
What we have just learned from an aide is that Hillary Clinton's doctor attended to her at her home in Chappaqua today.
Begin with that drama on Dancing with the Stars. You saw those two protesters rush the stage heading for Ryan Lochte right after his dance.
What would you do if you were elected about Aleppo?
About Aleppo.
And what is Aleppo?
You're kidding.
No.
Those are a few of the stories of the week. A bit out of context here on The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Joining us to hopefully find some context for this week's news is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello once again, Colin.
You know, Aleppo wasn't as funny as Groucho and Harpo, but that's no reason to treat him this way.
We may talk about that a little bit more during the course of the hour. Kevin Rennie's also here. He's a Hartford Current columnist. He also blogs at dailyructions.com. Hello once again, Kevin.
Good morning, John.
And we are bringing back the Rennie and Rennie Show, which played to some acclaim several weeks ago. Rennie Folco is here, professor of legal and policy studies at Trinity College. Hello, Adrian. How are you?
I am wonderful.
Well, if you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. So last week, Colin, we didn't really talk much about Hillary Clinton's health. A lot of the national conversation was about whether this was just some sort of a smeary, dirty trick that people who are associated with the Trump campaign were floating ideas about her health and stitching together videos that showed her to not be in good health. And then over the course of the last couple days, we see a sort of Clintonian thing happen, which is they don't exactly tell the entire truth about something, and then it ends up being newsworthy once again. What do we make at this hour of Hillary Clinton's health?
Well, I mean, first of all, as you're suggesting, the magic of the last few days has taken kind of a fringe idea and moved it into the mainstream. So there were people that were starting to be called Hillary Healthers in the traditions of birthers and truthers. And as that name suggests, they existed out on the fringes. They were trafficking in conspiracy theories. Hillary Clinton got caught in a combination of bad luck and misfortune of her own making. It's sort of a combination of the two things. This is a really bad time to get pneumonia when there's already this sort of conversation, this drumbeat going about what your health is. And so just to kind of review the timeline for people, what happened was we now know – well, what happened as we now know is that on Friday her doctor told her she had pneumonia. She decided that she would treat it as walking pneumonia. She would push through. She also decided that she wouldn't tell anybody except her immediate family and her closest aides. She then attended on Sunday this 9/11 observance. It was somewhat hot. It was somewhat humid. And suddenly, without alerting the press pool, she departed. And – she was unfortunate enough to have somebody capture her entrance into a van on video. That video went up on Facebook. People describe it in different ways, but she seems kind of jelly-legged at minimum. She's obviously not able to support herself on her feet. She's being helped into the van by a bunch of people. It doesn't look good. And I will now just put on my Trinity College media studies cap for a second and say this particular thing, she's in a really bad media trap here, which is that the value of stuff goes up if you're not supposed to see it. So one of the reasons that Romney's 47% speech got him in so much trouble was the content. But the other reason was you weren't supposed to see it, so it had a higher value. And so a video like this one, which you're not supposed to see, it's not part of any kind of political stagecraft, you were not meant to see this, people get a lot more interested in it. It gets circulated a lot more. We live in an age, obviously, where things can be circulated and where everything is the Zapruder film. You can take it and replay it and replay it and replay it until you decide what it is that you think that you're seeing there. So all of this has conspired to really, you know, put her in a very, very difficult position. And it feeds into two bad narratives. One of them is maybe there's something wrong with her health. The other one is she's not always as upfront about things as we'd like her to be. So she had pneumonia. She knew it on Friday. She decided not to tell anybody. She rolled the dice, you know, and she lost, and she lost big.
I will just quickly say, though, Colin, that the one difference I see between the Mitt Romney 47% moment is that is a, in some ways, scripted moment that is delivered to a crowd, and you're not supposed to see that outside of that crowd. So you're playing something that you're saying of your own free will to a group of people and not expecting that the rest of the world is going to see it. The fact is that no one expects to be jelly-legged or overheated or, frankly, to fall over getting into a van. That's a different sort of thing, I think, that is trying to be covered up.
Yeah, although, yeah, absolutely. I was just sort of saying that the value – I was doing my McLuhan thing. The value of this thing goes up just because you're not supposed to see it. But yes, but I think it also does peel back, you know, a whole bunch of layers on the Clinton onion. I mean, and now, you know, there's this second wave of stories basically saying, well, the real problem is that she won't listen to her aides about hydration, that there's been this tug of war. They want her to drink more water. I mean, it sounds like she's 5 years old, but they want her to drink more water. They can't get her to do it. And, you know, and then, like on social media, I've encountered, well, that's because she has to go to the bathroom too much. That's why she doesn't want to drink water. I mean, the conversation that we're having is kind of insane, except that it's not, because this is a woman who's, you know, I mean, like her opponent, a little bit later in life than your typical presidential candidate. John McCain, when he was running at the age of 71, released, I think, 1,200 pages of medical records. You know, so he said, look, I understand. I'm 71. I've had some health problems. Here, take a look. Here's everything. Neither one of these candidates are doing that, and instead, it's going drip, drip, drip. It's trickling out in a way that ultimately redounds to their discredit.
I'm going to turn to Kevin Rennie, who's been shifting uncomfortably in his seat since you said it was a hot and humid day in New York that day. But anyway, please, Kevin.
There were no reports of mass faintings at the 9/11 memorial. You know, this is what happens with the Clintons. They make things worse because they won't tell the truth. If she had said on Friday, you know, I've been diagnosed with pneumonia, taken a couple of days off, showed up on Sunday for a little while at the 9/11 memorial, I think there wouldn't have been much of a story. But that video is pretty jarring to see from behind, to see someone sort of looks like collapsing. And
so are we supposed to, because I think
and
we're
also, yeah, she is on the verge of becoming president of the United States.
Well, but I want to ask you about that. I mean, I was going to say putting things in buckets or perhaps baskets today of various types of things. Are we concerned about the near term and long term health of someone who could be president of the United States very, very soon? Are we concerned about potentially her or her aides not exactly telling the full truth about this? I mean, how much are we supposed to make of either of these two things, Kevin? Because I will just say lots of people, healthy people, get pneumonia all the time. And one way to look at a presidential candidate who develops pneumonia on the campaign trail and decides to soldier on is, well, that's pretty tough stuff.
If Barack Obama were diagnosed with pneumonia today, wouldn't we expect to know about it?
He's the president.
Yes.
Yeah.
She's close to being the president. You know, 8 years ago, John McCain's health was the subject of really ugly speculation by Obama supporters. This is someone falling down on the sidewalk.
I don't think she fell on the sidewalk, but she was stumbling as she got into the van. Yes,
she went face forward into that van, and without people holding her up by her shoulders, she would have been on the ground.
Rennie Falco?
Yeah, I'm going to be the contrarian here a little bit. I think if she'd come out and said she had pneumonia, it would have fed everything, only it would have been a different narrative. It wouldn't have been, I think, what Kevin said, oh, she has pneumonia, poor woman. It would have been, well, what does she really have? Does she really have lung cancer? I saw a report yesterday she had Parkinson's disease. I mean, I think the problem is that – first of all, this is what we're talking about. So for me,
sure,
doing what I do, the fact that, you know, we're a few weeks out from an election and we're talking about this, to me, is disturbing. But I think that, yes, she is a bad candidate in many ways. The Clintons, whatever you want to call it, there are things I think should be done differently. I don't disagree at all. But I still think it wouldn't matter in terms of how that would be treated were she to say, you know, she did not feel well. I just think it would have fed into it, but in a different way.
Something I saw from some Trump supporters on Twitter, actually, Colin, afterward, was when it came out that she had pneumonia, they were saying, well, prove it. prove that she has pneumonia, not something else.
Yeah. So this is the damned if she does and damned if she doesn't argument, and I've encountered it a lot over the last few days. I think the problem with it is that yes, you're absolutely right, everything that you're saying. If she'd announced on Friday that she had pneumonia, that would have led to a cascade of other kinds of conversations about what the pneumonia really was. Nonetheless, it does represent the Clinton camp kind of not learning from the past. So one of the things that they had a piece of information. She has pneumonia. The decision she made, let's sit on it, really, because that's worked so well for us in the past. You know, I mean, today we've got a hack of Colin Powell's emails. You know, these things happen all the time. One of the things that we know is it's very, very difficult in 2016 to keep a secret that people really want to know about somebody who's really important. These things
you're always on videotape. Yeah, right. Somebody always has the email.
Now, that's not how this came out. They ultimately just volunteered it themselves after they had another problem. And I do – it does raise a question.
You mean the – who – you mean the Clinton people volunteered it themselves? Or?
Well, yeah. Ultimately.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
all
ultimately
right.
– right. I mean, but you
I thought
don't,
you were talking about the Colin Powell emails.
No.
I didn't think they had.
If you don't want to be bringing up the pneumonia to explain the heat stroke, you know, I mean, because then you've really got a problem. And it does suggest to me that they're still doing the thing that they do over and over again. And a campaign is about fixing problems. If you've got a problem in a campaign, you lock it down, you fix it. You don't have a big conversation about whether the media is being fair. I mean, you can have that conversation separately, or whether you're being held to the wrong standards or a double standard or whatever. You fix the problem. She volunteered to try to win this election. She's trying to win this election against a guy that I personally find really scary. So I get annoyed when they handle things incompetently in a way that's going to blow up on them again.
I just got a tweet from Stewie who says, oh, please, the woman tries to soldier on and is treated like she's on death's door by the media. Guess why she doesn't tell you stuff? And an awful lot of people, Kevin Rennie, have said, well, you know, you don't necessarily have to volunteer every single thing about yourself to the press.
This is pneumonia. I mean, to me, pneumonia – I know Hillary Clinton said to Anderson Cooper she didn't think it was a big deal. But I think most people think of pneumonia as a pretty serious health issue.
And it can be a pretty serious health issue, certainly
especially
for people who get over a
certain
age. As
you get older, yeah.
So – Renee Falco, how much of this also just has to do with something that has come up over and over again in this campaign? Let's put the Clintons aside and the way the Clintons have handled things. Let's put some of the rumors aside that were circulating before all of this from the Trump supporters and just wonder about how much of a double standard happens because Hillary Clinton is Hillary Clinton. She's the first female candidate, and there's any number of different things that she's being asked to do or not do that any other candidate for president in the history of the world hasn't had to face.
Well, I do think that's true, and I think it's really hard to kind of separate things, right? Because we're talking about the Clintons. The Clintons aren't really running for president. I mean, we can make jokes about
sometimes
it.
We wonder.
But she's running for president.
I tended to think of Juan and Ava as the Perones, but that's just me.
But I do think there's a double standard, and I think that she is a problematic candidate. So I think there are two things going on. I think if she were a candidate more like, let's say, Barack Obama, I think she wouldn't be having some of the problems that she's having here. But she is – I don't think campaigning, as we all know, is her kind of natural space. I don't think it's what she is best at. But I also think that she is – there is a double standard about being a woman, how she looks, all of that stuff. I mean, how Trump looks, you know, we could make comments about that, but
well,
it's
we
not.
We do make comments about his.
People do all the time.
Bizarre.
But it's not. It's not the same. Mm. It's not disqualifying.
I don't agree about that. I mean, this man's appearance, I don't mind this, but this man's appearance has been ridiculed since day one, you know, that he's red-faced, he's orange-haired, that he's weird-looking,
teeny-tiny fingers.
But it doesn't – I don't think it has the same impact. That's what I'm saying. People – it isn't that it hasn't been ridiculed. It has. But I think a female candidate is just held to a different standard.
Well, she's ahead and he's behind. So I guess maybe the impact has been different.
For now. And so let's turn to another issue that came up, because this snafu over her health and whether or not to disclose her pneumonia was just one of a few things that she's had to deal with on the campaign trail. Now, speaking last Friday at a big ticket fundraiser in New York City, she said half of Donald Trump's supporters could be categorized into a basket of deplorables. Here it is.
You know, to just be grossly generalistic, you could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. Right? The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. And unfortunately, there are people like that. And he has lifted them up.
So putting back on your Trinity College Media Studies hat, Colin, I'll just say, when you start a quote with, you know, just to be grossly generalistic, and then you have to come back and later say, maybe I shouldn't have been so generalistic, that is a pretty bad way to start something. But what do you see in this basket of deplorables comment?
Well, I'm now going to make Stewie or whoever it was who tweeted at us, and possibly Renny Folco, a little happier. I mean, I've been sort of dueling with a lot of people over the last few days on social media over this question about whether it's fair to say the press isn't doing its job right. This is a case where the press did not do its job right, and I'm going to tell you why. Because, in fact, everybody does what we just did, which is play that part of the quote. Now, here's the rest of the quote. So she talks about that group of people. And she says, now, some of those folks, they are irredeemable, but thankfully they are not America. And then she says, like, nobody knows this, but the other basket, I know because I see friends from all over America here. I see friends from Florida and Georgia and South Carolina and Texas, as well, you know, New York and California. But that other basket of people who are people who feel that government has let them down, nobody cares about them. Nobody worries about what happens to their lives and their futures. And they are just as desperate for change. It doesn't really even matter where it comes from. They don't buy everything he says, but he seems to hold out some hope that their lives will be different. They won't wake up and see their they won't wake up and see their jobs disappear, lose a kid to heroin, feel like they're in a dead end. Those are people we have to understand and empathize with as well. So in that speech, what she was doing was making a demarcation. She was saying, look, like, half of his supporters are just total jerks. They're a basket of deplorables. I can't deal with them. I can't negotiate with them. There's not much I can say about them. The other half are people we really have to take seriously. They've got problems that are identifiable, that are understandable, and you can also understand why they might gravitate towards somebody like Trump. And she ends by saying, we have to empathize with those people.
But there's a reason why the media doesn't focus on the second half. It's because of the first couple words of the first half.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And the point is, it's so bad crafted, and it does so much of what Donald Trump has done over the course of this last couple of years, it seems, with almost everyone, from Mexicans to Syrians to almost everybody in America who doesn't agree with him. And that's the thing that I'm finding hard to grapple with, this notion that you can just throw a bunch of people into a basket. Now, whether or not there's a basket that they belong in is a whole different conversation. But when you're running for president, Kevin, I don't know, should you
tell us we're all better together? Isn't that what her slogan is?
That is.
You know, I wonder this. Only a few years ago, she announced that she was a supporter of same-sex marriage, which you may recall, sort of a famous interview with Terry Gross when she got kind of snippy about being confronted by that.
Yes.
Well, when she was opposing same-sex marriage, was she in that basket of deplorables as homophobic? Did she have a place in that? Is that what she means?
I don't know what she means. And that's, I think, one of the problems with it, Renny. I think that one of the problems with it is I don't know exactly what it means. I don't know how to get in or out of a basket of deplorables. I don't know if somebody in my family who might believe one thing that I don't agree with might be part of that basket of deplorables. And I guess it gets to this question of, if you're running for president of the United States, are you running to then lead all of the people? And it gets back to President Obama talking about Americans clinging to their guns and religion. And it gets back to Mitt Romney talking about 47% of Americans being takers. And it gets back to people grossly generalizing a whole group of people because of something that maybe they don't believe, but that a lot of other people do believe.
Well, I would just say that's kind of the bread and butter of politics is to talk that way. I mean, I don't find it's not so much that that's disturbing to me, because I think everybody does that in their campaign speeches. I think you can find it.
I don't think everybody – I think they do it at fundraisers when they're with friends.
Well, I would say Trump has done it in full view. I don't think it's been behind the screen. And I think the problem – the biggest problem for me is that if she wanted to talk about that, she should have talked about his failure to disavow – the people on the fringe who have been on the fringe and who now have been brought in. To me, that would have been a very reasonable thing to say. What she said was not the right way to say it.
And I just want to get back to you, Colin, because I've had some of these same arguments on social media with people who complain an awful lot about the press and what they cover. We often say that when Donald Trump talks like this, it's because he's playing to the base. He's trying to energize a base of people who believe that we should build a gigantic wall and keep all the Mexicans out. In a lot of ways, what Hillary Clinton is doing is the same. When she says that, she's playing the bass. You hear the laughter. You hear the cheering. And then I see on social media an awful lot of people saying, I agree with this notion. And what that sounds like to me is people who want to cheer the notion that I am smarter, I'm less racist, I'm better than the other. And that's one of the things that's going to energize me. And it feels, to use a non-technical term, really icky to me and not something that I want to support politically or otherwise.
Okay, so yeah, I think one distinction that's worth making here is, and everybody's kind of alluding to it in different ways, you don't want to run against voters ever. I mean, that was the problem with Obama's remarks about the people who cling to their guns. That was the problem with Romney's remarks about the 47%. You don't want to run against voters. You want to run against the person you're running against. And one thing that Trump has figured out rather cynically is you can maybe run against people who aren't voters. You can talk about, you know, very disparagingly about Mexican immigrants. But you won't hear Trump really attacking voters very often because it's just bad strategy. I mean, we can talk back and forth about whether it's good manners or not, but it's bad strategy. It doesn't work in your behalf very well. Now, having said that, and actually for the next few months, I'm going to be like stealing ideas from my students who are all very smart and come up with. I mean, you know, there is a theory that she wanted this out there. This is a phrase she's used at other fundraisers where the cameras have not been allowed in. This is not the first time she's had basket of deplorables. It isn't something that just slipped out. It's a phrase that she's used a lot. She probably made a calculated decision to use it again this time when there was going to be a recording equipment present. And so the argument there goes, she wants to have this conversation. She wants to force him into this conversation. You know, a couple of different press organizations, 538 in their, you know, pointy-headed little data head hearts, trying to analyze how true it is, you know, that half of his supporters fall into any of these categories. And what they sort of wound up saying is, you can say that on average – Republicans embrace some or all of these ideas, particularly about race, at a higher rate than Democrats, although sometimes not that higher rate. But it's harder to say, well, half of his supporters fall into that category. Jamelle Bouie in Reading and Slade said, no, this is true. Make this argument and get that conversation started. I'm guessing this didn't slip out, that she wants to have this conversation. She thinks, or at least thought back on Friday before all this other stuff started, she can make it work.
Incredibly, the campaign is getting closer, and I think it will become a race to get your base supporters out. And one way to do it is that kind of rhetoric. I mean, it just will. That's not landslide rhetoric. That's not let us unite and move forward rhetoric. That is, I need my people to get out, and here's the reason they should do it. This is what's at stake.
Yeah, and what I'm going to say is, you know, Elizabeth Warren, you know, has used some pretty strong language, right? And the same sentiment, but she's directed all of it at Trump, right?
Exactly.
And I think that to me that's where you can really see the difference. But I agree with Colin. I think that there were probably some who felt that this is a conversation that they need to have and that they want to have.
I want to just get to a couple.
I wouldn't say it's a conversation.
Well, no.
It's not a conversation. Well, it's political. It's political rhetoric.
Yeah, and there's going to be media coverage of it. There's
yeah,
gonna be
it's
kind
not
of
a conversation.
Out.
It will be. They will be fired like missiles at back and forth.
No, but we're talking about everybody's talking.
It's creating a conversation for us and for David and Woodbury. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, folks. The comment that Hillary said that was unfortunate. But getting back to what we're talking about first in New York City, Hillary was sitting in the hot sun in a crowd of people for a good hour and a half. And yes, she had pneumonia for since Friday. It was a Sunday, but it hadn't really kicked in. And it's very understandable that the heat got to her, plus the disease. And then yes, she stumbled getting into the car. But I really, but she'll get over that, and she'll come back and very soon. I think she'll do just fine.
Well, and David, I'm going to leave it at that. And thank you for your call. Quickly, Rennie?
Yeah, because I think what's important, if we want to talk about whether candidates should release medical records, I mean, I think that's a serious conversation. And I wish that there were more attention on that and what the expectation should be and why, as opposed to, I think, you know, just this is like, you know, what?
Well, if,
drama.
But if we have people talking about it, then maybe we'll have more medical records. John's in New Haven. Hi, John.
Yes, thank you. Couple of questions. First question is, when did the job of President of the United States become an entry-level position to government service? Donald Trump has no experience. He's a newbie. He wouldn't hire a brand new kid out of school to be CEO of one of his companies. Second point is, everybody's all in a tizzy about she's got pneumonia. She didn't release her medical records. Donald Trump's medical records that he released say all his tests were positive. Does that mean he has pneumonia, AIDS, dengue fever, lung cancer, brain tumor?
Yeah,
what did they test him for?
I think that his doctor used the word positive in probably the wrong medical sense. And John, thank you very much for that. A last call here from Joan in Washington, Connecticut. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I can't tell you how upset I am at this conversation. I'm very glad you've got this one woman who's talking about things with some degree of balance. I want to direct you to the fact that there is much. It's Wednesday, and you guys are still talking about this. One quick thing. Hillary was our senator on 9/11. I am convinced that she didn't release this information about being diagnosed with pneumonia on Friday because she didn't want to shift the attention to her away from the focus of 9/11. That's number one. Number two, we can talk about this doctor who's still unnamed, about whose results Mr. Trump is going to discuss on a TV talk show with Dr. Oz, and has already said, as has this Dr. Oz, that he will discuss only those things that are important to him, mm-hmm. that don't embarrass him. And in case anybody noticed, the Daily News, which I do not read, but I found this on the internet yesterday, quotes Trump saying in June to Hannity that half the country has been thrown under the bus by Trump with the statement that they don't have anything to do because the other half of the country is carrying them. Gentlemen and lady, I think that you have to be aware of the fact that many of us want you to start focusing on the important things that are happening, like the president's campaigning, the fact that employment is up, the household
I'm going to cut you off because I got to take a break. But that's what's on NPR every single day, and that's what we cover every single day here on our air. We're going to continue. Thank you for your phone calls. We're going to continue with Rennie Folco, with Kevin Rennie, with Colin McEnroe here on the Wheelhouse on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking with Rennie Folco, who's a professor of legal and policy studies at Trinity College. If that's not enough Rennie for you, we've got Kevin Rennie, Hartford Current columnist, who blogs at dailyructions.com, and also Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's in your show today, Colin?
I always wonder whether it fits into the conversation that we're having now. This time we're talking about this sort of subgenre of science fiction known as cyberpunk, which emphasizes kind of hacking, the lack of privacy in a digital environment, surveillance, things like that. And, of course, it started out maybe around the 1990s as science fiction. Our point today is we basically live in cyberpunk now. It's no longer science fiction.
Okay, so that's this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. We're going to move on to some other things in national news and also in local news. But very quickly, Rennie, I'd just like to talk to to you about something we were talking about just off the air now. We had a caller, a couple callers actually, who said some version of something that Colin and I in our jobs hear an awful lot, which is you, the press, aren't talking about the right things during this campaign. And there's an awful lot of me that says, well, yes, you're right, but I also think we've never had a campaign quite like this. We've never had a campaign so bereft of specific policy proposals that are going to change America, at least from one of the two major candidates. When you hear that, what do you think about this? Because for us, it's incredibly frustrating. We believe that there's an awful lot of coverage of all the candidates in a wide range of topics, but many, many people on both sides just clearly don't agree.
Yeah, and I think the frustration for a lot of people is that there seem to be many important things, not just the specific policy issues of the candidate, which, again, at this late date in September, it would be nice to know what they are.
Sure.
On both sides, right? But I think it's just it's like out of control. On my way in, I heard an interview with Maureen Dowd on CNN, and she has a new book out, and she was talking about this, about how really difficult it is to cover this campaign because it's not following any of the rules that we usually have in place. We have a candidate who's not just unconventional, but who himself is a master of the media. And that seems to me to be very different. We've had lots of unconventional candidates, but not with the kind of, I think, gut instinct that Trump has, so that he can control every news cycle.
And to that end, I'll just say our other caller, Kevin, said, you know, why are we going to have a political newbie obtain this highest ever office? Well, if one of the jobs of being president is knowing how to control the message and the media, Donald Trump's probably about as good at it as anybody who's ever attempted to get the office. That's where he's a professional.
Well, he won a lot of votes in the primaries. Why he's where he is. It's still quite unbelievable for a lot of us. And yeah, he's good at media, but you know, John F. Kennedy was good at media. Certainly, Barack Obama was very good at media, and so was Ronald Reagan. We've had very talented media savvy presidential candidates before. It's just they haven't come from reality TV and hucksterism in quite the same way. And it's certainly jarring. There's no doubt about it.
You know, obviously, one of the things that we hear, those of us who cover this kind of stuff, I mean, I've heard kind of in about equal measure from Trump people that I hate Trump. I'm trying to destroy Trump. They're not far off about that. I hear from Hillary Clinton people that I hate Hillary Clinton and I'm trying to destroy Hillary Clinton. And I hear from Bernie people saying that I didn't like Bernie enough and I didn't take him seriously enough. And everybody in the press hears that in this particular cycle, the press has been placed on trial. And I, for the most part, you know, don't think that's the case. I think one thing you have to say is that all of this stuff is kind of an intermeshed network of the intentions of news organizations. Yes, sometimes the financial incentives of news organizations. A lot of legacy news organizations are gasping for breath a lot of the time. Trump came along and goosed up their ratings, made debates more valuable to carry. You know, I mean, from the New York Times to, you know, to ABC and NBC, I mean, there's a lot of legacy news organizations that aren't that sure about the future. Trump came along and there's no question that he was worth a lot of money to them. And they said it. You know, there were quotes by Jeff Zucker and people and Les Moonves saying he's great for stuff like that. But the other part of this is people, too. You know, I mean, to Rennie's point about substance versus horse race, one thing we know, the Shorenstein Center has studied this up and down. People will read horse race stories before they will read substance stories. They always have. They always will. The two lines on a graph, they never even get close. I mean, people like to read this kind of coverage. They don't particularly like to read stuff about policy.
It's why people click the listicles at the bottom of the page at the end of the story, and they don't necessarily read the whole story. Just very quickly, I want to turn to one other thought on this, which is something that Donald Trump has talked about. And maybe some people are agreeing. After Matt Lauer got such poor reviews from hosting last week's Clinton-Trump forum, Trump suggested that they actually debate without a moderator. Some really bad reviews for Matt Lauer. What do we think about the debate format that we've had so far? We haven't had a real debate, but we had all of these debates coming through the primaries, Rennie, and now we're going to get into real debate season. I mean, I don't know. What should we be looking for? Should we change up the system?
Well, I guess I have a different question. Who thought it was a good idea for Matt Lauer to do that?
Not
I mean,
me.
He's not a serious, you know, I think.
Not anymore.
Well, I don't think – I mean, I would not. If I were naming the top five serious journalists who should be doing this, he wouldn't be among them. I mean, clearly it would be in Trump's interest to have no moderator because then he could be the only person talking on the stage.
After his Ryan Lochte bashing performance at the Olympics, I would have voted for Al Roker,
That's what I'm saying. I do think there are some of the people they've chosen are serious journalists. And the question will be, can they contain Trump? But I think to simply have a free-for-all, I'm not sure what does that do for us?
I believe that Chris Rock should have been the moderator of the first debate because I think you need someone up there who is not sort of part of the news establishment, who's going to sort of call them out on their nonsense. It's going to be – if it's going to be a circus, which it is, then – send in someone who is a very talented clown to keep them in line.
There are occasionally debate formats that build in. I can't remember if a presidential one has ever done it, but they build in moments where the candidates are allowed to address one another or ask one another a question. I've seen debates like that. But in general, we have moderators for the same reason that when Cavan was a state legislator, even if he was asking a question of Maurice Mosley, who was 10 feet away from him, he had to ask it through the speaker, who was 40 feet away from him. So in other words, parliamentary procedure is set up so that you don't have these kinds of clashes. So when Kevin would ask a question like that, he would say, "Mr. Speaker, I'd like to pose a question through you to the proponent of that bill." So rather than whirling towards the person sitting close to him and yelling some kind of question, because we basically don't want to see that. That's what, and we also don't think in terms of deliberation and bringing out opinions, that's the best way to get to it. What you have instead is people who get into the Caesar Milan red zone very fast with one another. So we're not going to not have moderators. It's a dumb suggestion.
But another quick suggestion, though, for this upcoming session of debates, Colin, is whether or not the moderators that we do have should be engaging in what we call live fact-checking. Like when somebody says something that you can say is patently false, is it the moderator's job or is it the other candidate's job to say, "I'm sorry, Mr. Trump or Ms. Clinton, you're not right about that"?
Right. So there's a lot of behind-the-scenes negotiations about what moderators can do and can't do. And at this point, Lester Holt is like watching game films of Matt Lauer, making sure he doesn't make these kinds of mistakes. But, you know, Candy Crowley famously challenged Romney on facts. Depending on your political leaning, that was either a very, very necessary thing to do or a horrible abuse of her power as a moderator. It always depends on whose ox is getting gored. Tom Brokaw, in moderating one of the earlier town hall debates, was initially told, "No, you're just going to call on people. You will not, you know, you're not going to be doing anything else other than, hey, okay, you, it's your turn. You ask a question." And Brokaw said, "I'm not doing that. That's not being a moderator." And in other words, if something happens as a result of an exchange between a candidate and one of the questioners in the audience, I feel as moderator, I've got to come back in and introduce some clarity to it or contextualize it. So don't tell me I'm not going to do it because I'm gonna. And I think moderators do, to some degree or other, have to do something other than keep the clock and point at people and ask questions.
Hey, Colin and I have both done this a lot. I've done it for gubernatorial races and for Senate races and congressional races, and I will say I would just step down off the stage if I was told that I couldn't question someone who was saying something that I knew not to be true. Kev?
I think it's going to be very, very tricky this year to try to correct the candidates because I think their partisans are hyper-partisans, and thus – It really isn't going to take any putting the thumb on the scale to get them all – to get each side worked up. It's just going to be any hard question is going to be viewed as unfair.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's a difference here. I mean, and I don't – I mean, Hillary, I think, is well-informed, right? So if the debates and if the questions are about information – it just seems to me she has an advantage. That doesn't mean her facts can't be checked or shouldn't be checked. I think what we've seen with Trump in every debate is that he really doesn't have information. He has information when he's reading a script with a teleprompter, but I don't think he is informed in the same way. And it seems to me the job of a moderator in this debate is to elicit real information.
And I think
I don't think it is. I don't think it will be. You know, yeah. I mean, the candidate does have some sovereignty over how they decide to answer the questions. It's frustrating, but they do.
But I think something that we've seen during the primary debates this year that we've never really seen before, Rennie, it's very true. we're not really getting substance questions hardly at all. We're going to get a series of questions about something that Donald Trump said. And then we're going to get a series of questions about Hillary Clinton's emails. And the problem is that to that end, Hillary Clinton may be the more informed candidate, but we're going to have very few chances for her to answer questions about information. We're going to have a lot of questions where she gets to answer, what do you think about something he said?
Well,
likewise.
And if I were running this show and I were the moderator, I would be at, maybe you have a few of those questions, but I would be really trying to talk about the issues because I think these debates are set up around specific issues like one is domestic, one is international. I mean, at least to the degree that it can be done, try to have that approach, which if you look at past debates, that is what happened.
They should have a debate about the cyber because I hear the cyber is so big, Colin. Last thought?
Well, I mean, you can coach a very uninformed candidate into debate proficiency if that candidate is coachable. The best example is Sarah Palin, who was a very uninformed candidate. She worked with a team. They taught her how to pivot. If you get asked a question that you don't have a good answer to, pivot towards the thing that we've gotten you to memorize the talking points about. And she did very well in her debate against Biden. I thought she you know, way outperformed expectations. Now, Trump is not coachable, and at least not so far. And my guess is that these debates will be very revelatory. You will see Hillary Clinton in all of her competence and proficiency, and you will see Trump being Trump. And I think Kevin's kind of right in a way that voters will wind up saying, well, I like that better than I like that. And I don't know which one of those things that any given voter is going to react to. A lot of what people react to anyway is very subconscious. You know, the researchers like Drew Weston who've looked at the ways that voters make decisions, they're often not decisions based on content, and they're also often not decisions based on much more than a few minutes of exposure.
Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show, Kevin Rennie from the Hartford Courant, Rennie Falco from Trinity College. When we come back, we're going to talk about a big ruling that was read from the bench about education funding in Connecticut. That's next in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm in The Wheelhouse talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe from WNPR, Kevin Rennie from the Hartford Courant, Rennie Falco from Trinity College. We're going to turn to a really big education ruling in the state. Superior Court judge ruled last week that Connecticut's system for funding public schools is irrational and unjustifiable, saying it fails to distribute funds fairly to benefit Connecticut students. The judge gave the state 180 days to come up with a plan to overhaul its system. The governor, Colin, and the attorney general sort of taking a look at whether or not they're going to appeal this ruling. One of the things that Governor Malloy said is, well, if it was like a five-page ruling, we'd probably say no. But, you know, a 90-page ruling, maybe there's something in there that we have to appeal. At the end of the day, I look at this and I see a judge that is not trying to fix Connecticut's education system as much as he's trying to fix Connecticut.
I think you might be right about this. First of all, I would bet quite a bit of money that they will appeal. But yeah, so just to put this in a tiny bit of context, and I'll do it really fast. So, I mean, the bare bones history of this is we started with Horton versus Meskel, which was a lawsuit long ago about equalization of funding and of education, and that sort of turned into the equalization formulas that we either live with or don't live with today. We went that from there to Sheff versus O'Neill, which essentially argued that, you know, it's not enough to do the money part of this, that if people exist in poverty and racial isolation, they don't get educated, they don't get equal educations anyway. You've got to fix that part two. This new ruling, I think, is the most holistic of the bunch. What he's really saying is it's not enough to fix the money part. If you just throw money at these problems and you spend it poorly, you're not going to fix the problem. You've got to look at all points on this star. You've got to look at what it means to live in some of these impoverished environments. You've got to look at how teachers are evaluated. You've got to look at how school construction is prioritized as against actual delivery of services. You've got to look at the special education system, how much money that eats up and what you actually get out of it. You got to look at all this stuff. If you just look at one part of it, it's not going to work. It's a very, very tall order, and I'm not really sure the people he's handing it to are equal to the task.
Kevin?
Well, you can read more about what I'm about to tell you in my column on Sunday in the Hartford Courant or online probably tomorrow morning. And that is, it is a meandering, cruel decision in the end, and it basically says that compassion in Connecticut is unconstitutional. It says remove children who have special needs from our schools. That's what it says. Why people who are hailing this as a victory refuse to acknowledge what it says about how we treat the disabled is the biggest mystery to me. But it says children who are not benefiting, special needs children who are not benefiting, stop spending money on them and take them out of our schools. That's what it says. I don't know what's wrong with Connecticut's leaders, but I know that the people of Connecticut are going to be appalled when they start to understand what this decision says.
That may be a piece of what it says, but as we've said, it goes quite a bit further than that. I guess I'm wondering if that's –
That's absolutely essential to all of this, because in the end, it says these children who are disabled have no place in our schools. That's what it says. It's right there in about six pages of the decision. You tell me, is that the Connecticut you want to live in?
It's a great question, which I'll put to Rennie Falco from Trinity College.
I would say that's probably not the Connecticut any of us want to live in.
Well, apparently it's one that a judge wants to live in, and it's one that people in who are leaders in this state have refused to comment on.
Yeah, well, I think I probably agree with Colin. I will be surprised, I'll say, if there is not an appeal, precisely because there's so much in it, and it you know, and I suspect that there will be aspects this even could be among them, right? I mean, in terms of the various points that can, you know, can be appealed. I mean, I haven't read anything yet. I don't know, so I don't want to speak, you know, authoritatively. But it would seem to me that that's likely. But if it's not appealed, I mean, this has been an issue that has been on the table for so long and has not been resolved. And I'm not sure how one gets to a resolution of this problem.
But just so we're clear about this, this is not a case about special education. McCosher introduced special education as one of the many points on the star that he said, you have to look at all of this stuff. You can't just look at one thing.
It didn't start out as a case about special education, but it is now.
But that's in the decision. But it's not.
That's right.
Kevin, I just want to make sure people who are listening understand. This is not a decision about our special education system. It's a decision about the overall education system, looking at a lot of different elements of it, of which special education, you're absolutely right, is one point of this. But just so that the listeners understand, what it is a case about why we continue to get unequal outcomes out of this system in what appears to be contravention of a constitutional requirement in the state of Connecticut that, in fact, we deliver public education to everybody.
And I guess my point, Kevin, is I think what Governor Malloy was saying and other commenters are saying about this very, very lengthy ruling in which the judge went much, much further than anything that plaintiffs in the case were asking for. There's a lot in there to question. The meat of it is about this unequal opportunity. The meat of it is about the fact that –
You say the meat of it. Say the meat of it. But here's something that says, take these children out of our schools. Well, who's going to decide that, and which children are going to be removed from our schools?
Well, when I say the meat of it, what I'm talking about is
that's not meat of it?
No. What I'm saying is unequal educational opportunities for the kids of Bridgeport versus the kids of Fairfield, the kids of Hartford versus the kids of Glastonbury.
But it's there in the decision. It's there, for instance, that apparently all the municipalities that their contracts with teachers are also unconstitutional.
Right.
And therefore,
he's bringing up a lot of different things. But I think it's fair to say that you could implement the heart and substance of this decision and not touch special education. He's got some ideas about special education. But in terms of what would satisfy the requirement.
This isn't a term paper. This is not a term paper. This is a court decision with, at the moment, some force of law behind it.
So my question to you, Colin, is it written too much like it's a term paper and written too little like it's something that could be implemented in 180 days by the state? It seems capricious on that end that this is something the state's going to fix in a couple months.
Yeah, it's written like something that's meant to ignite a conversation, right? I mean, and it has, and it's gotten
national. We've done again, yes.
It's written with very florid and at times semi-poetic language. It has attracted a lot of coverage from all over the country. I would agree that in terms of nuts and bolts, this is a hard thing to take and say, okay, here's the blueprint. We just have to do what's in this decision, and we'll fix the education system. He's really making a whole bunch of arguments, some of which are probably unusable in any kind of practical way. But I think he is trying anyway to start that conversation.
That's what you do in an op-ed. That's not what you do in a court decision. It is grossly irresponsible.
And we just have 30 seconds, Rennie?
What I would say is that I think it is going to be extremely difficult and will stimulate a great deal of conversation.
And we've already stimulated some conversation about quite a few topics today, as a matter of fact, with Adrian Falco, professor of legal and policy studies at Trinity College. Thanks so much, Rennie.
You bet.
Thanks also to Kevin Rennie, Hartford Current columnist. You can read more about this in the Hartford Current this weekend, or so I hear. He's a former Republican state senator. He blogs at dailyructions.com. Read it online. Thanks, Kevin. And thanks also to Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you, Colin.
Thank you, Mr. Dankowski.
Our program is produced by Katie Tolarski. Thanks to Kion Wolf, Heather Brandon, our digital editor. You can find us, WNPR.org/thewheelhouse.